ask about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Lee Behrman, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing the surf. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Lee a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Lee about fly fishing the surf. Whether fishing for trout in the Rocky Mountains, chasing silver salmon in Alaska, or jumping tarpon in the Florida Keys, the Platte River Fly Shop online store has all the top brands you will need to gear up for your trip. They are Wyoming's largest Sims and Patagonia dealer, keeping a large variety of popular items in stock year-round. You might even find a great deal in their closeout section, from rods and reels to waders and boots. And if you're headed through Wyoming, make sure to put the Blue Ribbon North Platte River Tailwaters on your bucket list. Log on to WyomingFlyFishing.com today and check out their store, or give them a call at 303-237-5997. That's 307-237-5997. Or visit them at their website, WyomingFlyFishing.com. Before we introduce Lee, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away 1-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Lee's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Lee's book, Fly Fishing the Surf, courtesy of Amato Books. And to find out more about what Amato Books has to offer, go to amatobooks.com. And here's how you can win. Be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And there might be 2 questions, so pay attention. The question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, type fast, and maybe you'll win Lee's book. Our guest tonight is Lee Behrman, and Lee's love of fly fishing began at an early age when his maternal grandfather showed him how to catch muskie in the lakes of northern Wisconsin. Milwaukee to Oxnard, California in the early 60s, that love continued, not only at the local lakes in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties, but on the beach where he grew up. As a child, Lee began fishing from the docks with a 50-cent drop line, graduating from there to spinning gear, then to a long surf rod, and finally to a fly rod. Lee fishes the Southern California surf at least 300 days per year. Whether guiding for his business, fly fish the surf, or just for fun, Lee has caught barred surf perch, corbina, halibut, leopard shark, striped bass, and all of the other surf species. When Lee is not fishing in the salt water, you can find him in the local canals guiding for carp. Lee also spends at least 2 or more weeks per year in Baja California in the waters of the Sea of Cortez, where his bull candy fly has been lauded by Pam Bowles of the Baja Big Fish Company. On most Fridays, Lee can be found at Eric's Tackle in Ventura, California, tying flies and spreading the word on the ease of fly fishing from the beach. Most conventional fishermen express surprise at the fact that there is a sport like fly fishing in the surf. Lee is also on the pro staff with Ray Jeff Sports, Waterworks Lamps and Fly Reels, Solaris UV Epoxy, Sakwa Water Shoes, and Dr. Slick Fly Tying Equipment. Lee is a full-time fly fishing guide living in Oxnard, California with his wife, Karen, and their Akita dog, Nana. Lee, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger. Glad to be here.
Well, we'll start this again. Just everybody had some technical difficulties, but hopefully everybody will refresh and be on with us here. And I'll just do a double check and see. Yeah, looks like we've got some people that have joined us now, so good. Okay. So let's start with Lee talking about you know, what is surf fishing, the kind of surf fishing you do, and how that might translate to other parts of the world, if possible.
Well, once again, the main thing that you have to have on the beach is structure. You don't really want to fish a flat beach, and structure is defined really by anything that is, it has depth. And the depth gets in the sand via the waves. And the waves can either be big or they can be pushed by wind, and they're going to cut structure. So it matches other areas of the world. It's universal in the sense that if you've got waves crashing or breaking on the beach, you should have structure. So that's universal. The only thing about, like, the book that will differ from areas is the species that we have here.
Okay. And I know we're going to talk, you know, real specifically about the structure. So really, you know, if given the factors you just said, we could be in Baja, we could be in Florida, we could be on the East Coast, and a lot of what we're going to talk about tonight will still apply. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, good. Let's talk about, at least in your neck of the woods, what kind of fish are around there that are accessible?
The majority of the fish that are going to be caught are what we call the barred surf perch, and they're kind of an underrated fish in that they fight really good, especially on fly gear, you know, because we're using, let's say, lighter stuff than some of the guys. If you have a 16-foot conventional rod, you've got maybe 20-pound test and a 3-ounce sinker, whereas we're fishing, I like 6-weight rods, and, you know, anywhere from a 200-grain to a 240-grain sinking line, and then a lightly weighted fly. So you can really feel those smaller fish. The perch that we catch range from, you know, they can be an inch up to, during a good year, when the big females come in, they can get up to 15, 16 inches. Other than that, we have what we call the West Coast bone fish, which is a corbina. That is kind of the goal of everybody, is to catch one of those. They're very spookish. Then you have the bottom fish, like a halibut or a shovel-nose guitar fish. There's just a ton of things, and people will always kind of, well, I can use the word freak out, when they know that you can catch sharks from the beach. And on the West Coast, we have leopard sharks. We have gray smoothhound sharks, would look like a leopard but without the spots. So there's quite a few species, and if you're lucky, you might find a striped bass coming by every now and then. And I have hooked 2 steelhead down this way in Southern California, but they both broke off. So The joy of the beach is you never know what you're gonna hook.
Yeah. I know. I used to do a lot of diving off the beach in Santa Barbara and out at the islands, and so I had a kind of a sneak peek out there beyond the surf line of what things looked like. But I think we're going to end up talking about what's actually in that surf line, aren't we, that's reachable from shore. We had Mark Angus, upstate New York. He says, have you had much experience on the East Coast, specifically Long Island, for stripers, bluefish, and fluke? Have you done any shore fishing out there?
No, I haven't been able to make it to the East Coast. I have friends that go out there almost every year, and I've been invited. But my free time that I can actually get away is really spent down in Baja. I did make one trip to Louisiana and went out there. But this is a job now, so I'm pretty busy. So it's kind of hard to get away. And fish as much as I'd like for other things.
Yeah, one thing we were talking about before we started the show, Lee and I were talking about, is how many people he gets stopped in, you know, on their way to somewhere else or vacationing and going out for a day fishing with him in Southern California. And likewise, you know, when Mark asked about, you know, stripers and bluefish, we did a show, well, we've done a couple of shows on stripers and one on bluefish in New York. And I was surprised to find out that, if you're doing business in New York City, even, you can almost take a subway down to the point where you can hook up with a guide and go bluefish fishing right from New York City. You know, it's only like 30 minutes from downtown or something. So I think about anywhere in the world, if you seek out, you can find some fishing to be done. But anyway, I was just surprised to find that. David, Yorba Linda, California, a little south of you, says, Lee, what's your take on the barred surf perch bite in Southern California this winter and spring? What do you think contributes to the slow perch fishing? Warm water, lack of sand crabs on the beach, what?
It is something that has come up. It really, in January, we were doing real good on the beach. The only thing that along the timeline that was different is we had a big storm come in February, and it seemed to change everything. And I'm really not sure if it is the water, because the water isn't really different temperature than it was last year. We have had a lack of large fish in the perch category. We are getting a lot of smaller fish, so there are fish. But I was guiding yesterday, and a gentleman that I know came by, and we even talked about this. And I've talked to a lot of people, and in our area, we haven't seen the pregnant female perch come in yet. And that's usually what a lot of people wait for, because they're big fish. And we haven't had that, so we don't know if it's ecological, if it's cyclical, or what it is. I usually tell people, I'll give you the most educated answer I have, and I shrug my shoulders.
Yeah, yeah. Now, do those perch, do they migrate, or are they just
Nothing is known as far as that. We don't know if they stay in an area, if they move. You know, there really isn't much known, because that would entail, I guess, tagging them and putting monitors in them or on them, and, you know, nobody's really done that. But every beach has them. So, you know, I mean, I've gone down into Mexico, and on the Pacific side of Mexico have caught them. So they're from way up north all the way down into Baja. You know, it's a large area they cover. They're a very, very hardy fish.
Do you know how far north they get, or they get all the way up to Washington?
I know that they get up probably, I would say, closer to San Francisco. I'm not sure if they go much above that, or, you know, they might. I just haven't gone up there, nor have somebody up there really contacted me. I know in the San Francisco they're there because a gentleman contacted me and purchased some flies. So I know they're at least up that far.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about some of the equipment that you're using. Roy in Fukushima in Orange, California, wrote in and asked, as saltwater fly fishing has become more popular in Southern California, especially surf fishing from the beach, what type of fly gear would you suggest? Are there websites that specialize in Southern Cal saltwater fly fishing?
There are websites. You could probably just type in you know, surf fly fishing websites or chat rooms or bulletin boards and find them. You can even go to the conventional gear ones, because a beach is a beach. They're just using different gear. But as far as gear goes, there's two separate things, like in, let's see, Roy's question there, and one is saltwater fly fishing and one is beach. It used to be where we would tell people, if you're going to fish the beach and you can only have one rod, we'd tell people, get an 8-weight, because you can fish a 300-grain line on it during the winter when our surf is bigger, and during the summer when the surf is smaller, you could fish a 200 or a 240-grain line, so you could cover that. But one of the things that my friends and I that were talking about that did is, we eventually all dropped down to 6 weights, and we found that there isn't much we can't do on the beach with a 6-weight that we couldn't do with an 8, with the exception of chasing big leopard sharks. So it's kind of a needs-based question. If you're going to fish the surf, I'd say a 6-weight with a matched line. you know, match the rod to your style, match the line to the rod so they both work for you, not against you. I use the analogy that if you owned a Porsche, you wouldn't put off-road mudding tires on it. So it's the same way with the rod and the line. You want them working together. You know, you can get reels from $35 to $300 to do this, so that's another needs-based if you're going to do other fishing than maybe, you know, a better drag system. But there's some composite reels out there for $35 that work just fine. It's really what you want, so I try not to ever say a very specific setup. You know, it's because...
Yeah. So somewhere between 6 and 8, though, is where you want to be. And Terry Martin in Portland, Oregon asked, do you have a special rigging you use, and do you use sinking line or a sink tip line?
Well, yeah, I guess there's, you know, the semantics on how that's worded. The sinking line... Some people still think of the line as from end to end being sinking, and you want to stay away from that. You don't need that in the surf. It's just too much weight. So what we're using now is what is referred to as an integrated sinking line. So it's a fly line, and there's a seamless weld into the sink tip. So it's real nice. They're really nice to cast. So those are the best ways to go. Once again, you've got to match that line to the rod. So if you have a 6-weight, I mean, you can go light. You could fish 190 grain on it. You can fish maybe a 260 grain on it. The difference is the lighter line, you have to carry more line in the air to load the rod, whereas a heavier line, you don't have to carry as much line in the air to load the rod. I hope that makes sense.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yep, got that extra weight in the air pulling that rod back. So, yeah, that makes sense. What about rigging like terminal tackle? How do you rig up, and what do you use?
My whole philosophy is keep it as simple as possible. And when I guide, I run about 8.5 feet of 8-pound fluorocarbon off the sinking line. I put a braided loop on the end. I put a loop in my leader and put it right on there. So there's no tapered leader. That weighted line and that weighted fly, if cast properly, will turn over just fine. However, now when I say that, if I go down to 6-pound or 4-pound, I will cut the 8.5 and then tie the 6 or the 4 onto that, because I just don't want to run straight 4-pound.
Okay.
It's very, very simple. If you want to make your own taper leaders or buy taper leaders, there's not a problem with that. It's just, it's not needed. Not like throwing a floating line with a dry fly or even a little nymph, you know.
Yeah. Well, we got a question here that came in on the Internet. Richard in Seaside says, Lee, what is your favorite go-to line to use for the surf if specific species... barred surf perch, so he's asking for the surf perch. And he says mine is the Rio outbound short fast sink. Do you have a preference?
Well, I do, but the philosophy that really goes with what the simplicity factor with me is, there's no right or wrong way to do this. There's only the way you do it, as long as it works and doesn't cause you pain. So if that line is working for him, that's perfect. And one thing that I found out with rods and with lines and with reels, it's just like talking to somebody about what scotch they drink or what cigars they smoke. We all have our preferences.
Yeah, well, I know a lot of the line manufacturers now are making, they're getting, you know, as in the past 20 years, the lines have gotten more specific. You know, you've got panfish line, you've got bonefish line, you've got... you know, and the line that works better for a certain temperature water, you know, those kind of, you know, specifications. So
everybody needs to contact Tim Rajeff up at Rajeff Sports and tell him you want Lee to do his surf line. I've been trying to get him to do a surf line, but the line that I use, and I get a lot of lines that I get to beat on, so I get to test them out. And what I use on my 6-weights is the Airflow Sniper Cold Water Type 7 sink, but it's for an 8-weight. And for what I do then is I cut 2 feet off that sink tip. So I get, it's for an 8-weight, but I cut 2 feet off, and it casts on my 6-weights just beautifully. And I know.
Can you repeat that again? It was Airflow?
Pardon me?
It was, can you repeat it again? Airflow
sure.
What?
It's Airflow Sniper Cold Water, and it's a Type 7 sink for an 8-weight, and I cut 2 feet off.
Okay, okay. Oh, there you go, Richard. That's his favorite. So, and I know it makes a big difference, water temperature, too, of where you're at. You might be using a different line if you were surf fishing in Washington State or Maine versus Southern California or even, you know, the Keys in Florida, right? I mean.
Correct. The one thing nice about the Airflow lines is you can go to the Ray Jeff Sports website and look up the Airflow lines, and there's a gauge. It'll tell you the temperature range that they're good in. And I've taken these lines on the beach here. Our water's probably between 56 and 58 degrees right now. But I've also thrown them in water that's 80 degrees, and I have not had any problems with that line. I have used some other earlier Airflow lines where there was a difference, but I haven't run into them, you know, lately.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we need to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk more about fishing the surf in Southern California. Harper Creek Fly Fishing Company is North Carolina's premier backcountry fly fishing guide service. Located in Lenoir, North Carolina, at the base of the Blue Ridge Mountains, they fish some of the most beautiful limestone spring creeks North Carolina has to offer. Their guide has over 15 years of professional experience in the area, and in addition to their backcountry guide service for experienced anglers, they offer intensive full-day instructional trips for the novice angler. So go spend a day with them in fly fishing paradise. For more information on their services, please visit www.nc-flyfishing.com. That's nc-flyfishing.com, or call them at 828-758-2446. That's 828-758-2446. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Lee Behrman about fly fishing the surf. If you'd like to ask Lee a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. To Lee, I always ask my guests what's going on in your fly fishing world, so tell us what you do down there in Southern California.
Well, I guide full-time on the beach, and if I'm not guiding, I'm usually fishing, and if I'm not fishing, I'll have gone by the beach that day. So I'm pretty much, as I refer to it, the wet sand. I'm always on the wet sand or near it to check out the conditions. I guided yesterday and fished the day before, so, you know, it keeps me busy, or as a friend says, it keeps me out of the bars.
Sure. Now, do you have a website people want to...
Right. Everything, it's real simple, like the book. It's flyfishthesurf@yahoo.com. I'm sorry, that's email, but the
right.
Website is flyfishthesurf also. Everything is the same. Made it real easy.
Okay, flyfishthesurf.com?
Right.
Okay, good. Okay,
and that
great.
Has a lot of information, has a lot of pictures on it, and... also has ways to contact me.
Okay, good. DB in Escondido wrote in and he says, stripping baskets. The manufactured hard plastic ones appear like they would be awkward and uncomfortable to use since the width and length are relatively large. Am I wrong on this? What are the most important features and relative sizes for a good stripping basket for Southern Cal beaches? I'm thinking I would like to make my own. Do you think that most people that make their own are satisfied with the results?
There are, there's a few websites or there's a few places on the internet where you can see how to make your own, and they're fine. I've seen them from large trash cans to small little something you'd put your silverware in. So it's whatever you make as long as it works. However, you have to have enough area, meaning inside the walls of that basket, to where you can strip that line back and put it in there without having to think about it. If you have to think about where you're putting that line, you're not paying attention to what's going out there in the water, and you could miss a fish. So it's important to make sure it is big enough. So, and also, if it's big enough, if there's a little breeze, the line won't blow out of there. The other thing, if you make one, homemade one, you need to put some kind of separating device in there for the coils that the line gets as memory while sitting on the reel. And the ones that you can buy will have separating cones in them. Then the only thing you need to do is drill holes so you get water drainage if water gets in there. Most people that when I guide, if they show up and have their own, I have them use the ones that I like, and they generally then will go get one of those because it's a good size, it fits well. You know, for a long time people didn't want the hard plastic baskets because they said they don't travel well. Well, I just put it in my suitcase and pack inside the basket, so it really doesn't take up any. And there's some good ones made out there, and unfortunately some of them have gotten quite pricey, but you can probably still get them between $55 and $65.
And which one do you prefer that you give out?
I'm real partial to the Line Curve. It's out of Denmark. Gentleman, how fitting, his name is Lars, and he had them, and I was importing them for quite a while from him, but now Temple Fork Outfitters is importing them. So any fly shop that deals with them can get them. They're a green basket, and they're almost the same design as the old L.L. Bean basket, which was great. And
Is that the one that's on the cover of your book?
Yes.
Okay.
And if I can make one recommendation, and is if you go to drill your holes in the basket, don't drill them too big. Some guys like to drill half-inch to inch holes so it drains fast, but if you ever want to put anything in the basket, like if you're going to change flies, I've seen people drop the fly in the basket and it goes out the holes. I use a quarter-inch drill bit, and I probably drill 10 to 12 holes, and most of them are in the front half of the basket, not even in the back. And if you really are getting in a situation where you're getting that much water in the basket, you need to back up about 30 feet. Don't put yourself in any danger.
Yeah. Is that also on page 83, the same one there? Is that what you're talking about?
There is a section on stripping baskets. I fortunately don't have a book in front of me.
Oh, okay.
It would be the green basket.
Yeah, this is a picture. It says my typical surf setup, and I can see those cones inside the bottom of it.
Yes.
Okay.
Most of the manufactured ones have a cone like that. So that, you know, you need that to separate the coils in the line. But a strange thing happens if you walk 50 feet, the fact that your thigh is hitting or causing the basket to move forward and back, those coils can go inside of each other, so you could walk 50 feet, and next thing you know, you've got tangled line. So, you know, it can happen that way, but some people refer to them as tangle baskets, but they are a very necessary item on the beach.
Okay. Well, just backpedaling here a bit, a question on the Internet that came in. Phil McCartney wrote in and said, what species of fish are available consistently more or less year-round as opposed to a few weeks as they might migrate past your local area? Would that be the perch?
Yeah, that would be the barred surf perch, yeah.
Okay.
California, the Corbina, we get them in Ventura and Santa Barbara County later in the year than they do down, let's say, in San Diego. The warmer the water, the more active they are. So they like the warm water. They will move up the coast as the water gets warm. And you more than likely, I hate to say never and only, but I doubt it very much that you'll ever catch a corbina past the Santa Barbara Harbor because the water just starts getting colder up that way.
Good to know. Good to know. Okay. Another question off the internet is Richard in Monterey Bay. He says, do you like fishing with a single or multiple fly tippet?
I have fished two flies. I think you need to be a better caster with two flies. Otherwise, you're going to get a lot of tangling. You've got to wait a little longer on your back cast before you come forward. I also like to, if I use them when I cast out, I like to count the splashes and make sure there's two, not just one big one. There is a way of doing it, and once again, I'll get into the simplicity factor. Guys were using small three-way swivels, but that's more knots, and what I found is I could take 8-pound, tie a double overhand knot with the fly in the loop at the, on the end of the knot, and put that through twice, and if I pinch the eye of the hook, when I tighten that, I will get a very tiny loop, and that so it'll give that fly some action. Then about 12 to 18 inches behind that, I tie my unweighted fly. So my weighted fly is on the bottom. My unweighted fly is up in the, on the very end on, in the water column. And I have gotten corbina on the leading fly. I've gotten them on the trailing fly. So it that double overhand loop, you know, knot there will hold well. But I haven't been able to duplicate that on anything less than 8-pound.
Mm-hmm.
Hope that helps.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Another question here from Don in Sanborn, New York. He says, Lee, I've traveled to saltwater destinations a few times and have always wanted to try fly fishing the surf. I have 7 and 8 weight gear that I use for salmon and steelhead fishing on the Great Lakes tributaries. Could I use this equipment surf fishing? And I think he's right in that range of 6 to 8, right?
Yeah, those that's perfect.
Yeah. And then he also asks, which is a good question for people that are used to freshwater fishing, he says, what do I need to do to protect my equipment from the saltwater?
Well, it depends on how new the equipment is, because a lot of the manufacturers nowadays are making gear that is, you know, we for the surf, I like a rod with a fighting butt. And most of the rods, even if they have a fighting butt and they were for the salt or the freshwater, they're still not as delicate as, you know, gear used to be. So, you know, a simple rinsing them off will work fine. I wipe my rods down with Lemon Pledge. I spray it on a rag and wipe them down, and it keeps them, you know, the anything from sticking to them, and it keeps them fine. And I use the Waterwork lamps and reels, which I don't have to do much. When people talk to me about reels, I tell them if you like to fuss with your reels, if you like to pull them apart and clean them and do all that and get in there and see how they work, well, don't get those because you don't need to. If I go for 2 weeks in Baja and I'm fishing 12 days, I don't clean any of my gear until the day before I leave. And it'll be fine, you know, but I clean it before I put it away then for the trip home. But the answer to his question, if you rinse it off with water, you'll be fine.
Okay. Okay. Good. And this is Jason Stacy in Ashland, Kentucky. He says, I'm just getting back into fly fishing after many years of not doing it. I never fished the surf with a fly rod, so I was wondering if there was a certain length rod that you would use. So we talked about weight, 6 to 8 weight. I don't remember if you mentioned length or not.
I personally use all 9-foot rods.
Okay.
I know the one gentleman was talking about fishing the East Coast, and there they might use a longer rod. They get bigger surf. Kind of here, if the surf is that big, we don't fish. A lot of people surf, so if the waves are big, they surf. If they're not, they fish. And a 9-foot rod is fine. There are some people that I know that are fishing switch rods and spay rods, which are anywhere from 10 feet, 10 inches up to 13 feet. But to a person, those guys are doing it because they have shoulder issues. And a two-handed rod leaves the shoulder problem. So a nine-foot rod is really all you need.
Okay, okay. Another question from Joe, Richmond, Texas. He says, have you ever had an episode, because you mentioned this before about getting water in your basket like you're too far out, so this is kind of an appropriate safety question. Have you ever had an episode when you were caught by an undertow, and what did you do?
The only time that I have ever had a problem is I was walking in probably knee-deep water over some rocks that had moss on them in the ocean that were in real close, and I did tumble over there, but I don't go out to where I'm in danger, and I never put any of my clients in. I mean, we really don't ever go over our knees. It's not worth that. There's no fish out there that I've found is worth getting, you know, in a predicament that's not going to be safe. It's, you know, I was asked one time about if I went to the beach and the surf was 7 foot, what would I do? How would I fish it? And I said, I wouldn't go get out of my truck. I'd go have breakfast.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so there, it's not worth it. It's if you're sitting on a dock and there's a lot of wind and big swells and it's all choppy, you know, you kind of go, huh, I don't want to go out that day. It's the same way with the beach. If it's that, you know, even if it's, but if it's like a lake, you can, without surf that day, you can go out farther. But it's still the fish, if you're standing in ankle-deep water and you can throw 60 feet, you're in fish-catching distance.
Mm-hmm.
So if you went out to your waist and you threw 60 feet, you could theoretically be throwing past where the fish are.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, if you're standing in ankle-deep water and you can throw, let's say, 80 feet at a max, your chances of catching fish go up greatly, and you don't really need to throw any farther than that. And the joy of the weighted line is the energy created going from, you know, your back cast to your forward, that energy of that weighted line will pull a lot of line out of your basket just like that. So, you know, it's not hard. The hardest thing to do is the timing change between a weighted line and a floating line. That's the big difference.
Okay. Yeah, now, a lot of freshwater fishermen might be leery about when you say an 80-foot cast. That's a pretty long cast in the freshwater world.
Yeah.
So is that a long cast for you, or is that a standard cast that you need to be prepared to make?
Depending on the size of the waves, the swell, I throw as far as I can. The farther I throw, the more sand I cover, the more chances I have of catching fish. Just like, you know, if you look at all the fish you've ever caught, none of them move a great distance to hit a fly or a lure. You know, they really don't move far. So think of it this way. You're throwing and you're bringing it back. Now, if a perch is at, let's say a perch is at 60 feet, and you throw it 55, you're not going to get bit. But if you throw it 65 and bring it through where he is, you're going to get bit. That's why distance. And a lot of people that come from a very dedicated trout background do get kind of freaked out when I talk to them about distance. But once they start getting comfortable with a weighted line, if you have a stroke, if you can go, you know, from your forward to back, and you can do it well, you can cast a weighted line. And 60 feet isn't anything in that a lot of the sink tips up out there are between 24 and 30 feet. So if you have that and a leader and you can double that length just with your colored fly line, the running line on it, you'll have 60 feet.
Uh-huh.
So it's really not hard. I get clients and I'll tell them, don't say you can't, because you can. And within a while, they can do it, and they're kind of amazed. It's, you know, the positive thinking aspect. But it's not, I don't want to say it's not hard. because if it was easy, everybody'd be doing it. You know, the thing that draws all of us to fly fishing is the fly casting. So salt water is fun because you can throw, you know, distance.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's good to know. They're probably, yeah, a lot of freshwater folks might not be used to throwing heavier lines like that and not realizing how much.
One of the things I do, Roger, if it's somebody that is local, if they're not too far away and they call me up and they say, you know, I've been trout fishing for 20 years, I want to have you take me out on the beach, I'll actually meet them beforehand. If they're working, I'll meet them at a park after work and let them try to cast the rod. And if they can, then we set the date for the beach. If they go, huh, this is harder, then what we'll do is we set a date for a casting lesson.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the same time during the casting lesson, I introduce them to a stripping basket because, once again, the more that you learn in the park on the grass, the less you have to think about when you're standing there on the beach.
Right.
And, you know, the less you have to think, the better you do.
Right, right. Okay, let's take a quick break again, and we'll come back. We got a couple more equipment questions. We'll talk about food and flies out there and some finding structure and presentations. So stick with us, folks. We'll be right back. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide service to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging on to their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Lee Behrman about fly fishing the surf. If you'd like to ask Lee a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Use that Q&A text box to send us your question, and we'll try to answer it immediately during the show tonight. Okay, let's see here. Oh, we did get an equipment question. Phil McCartney wrote in and wants to know, what sort of waders do you recommend and what features are important?
Well, the best feature is they don't leak. And,
yeah. You know, that's always a good feature. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. The chest-high ones are fine. I personally right now I'm using waders that are made by Aquas. And Aquas makes them for Patagonia. They make all the Patagonias, and they're telling me that they might start making them for Reddington and possibly Sims. And I really like them. As far as what's needed, you know, you can get them with a boot on them. You can get them with just the, you know, the sock foot where you wear your own boots. You know, I've had clients come out to the beach with waders and not have your typical wading boot, but they've got old tennis shoes. The problem with that, though, is they'll fill up with sand really quick. Mm-hmm. Sand gets everywhere, and even with good gaiters on your over your boots and that, you'll still get sand in the boot. But, you know, that's for the waders. You know, some days it's real nice to have those if the water isn't too warm and the outside temperature is cold. They're very comfortable. But, you know, once again, waders are kind of a personal preference, you know, brand-wise. You know, I had a pair the one time that had the little hand warmer place, and that was kind of neat. But just whatever, you know, you can get them to fit any bill now.
What about some of the young bucks out there like to wet wade? I don't care if it's snowing, they're wet wading out there. Any safety issues with doing that and wearing sandals or something out in
the
surf?
Well, I do wet wade, you know, and I'm in my bathing suit, but I always make sure I have some kind of footwear. I've worked with David at the Sakwa Company, and he makes a really nice booty that's got a wide elastic strip, and it's the best one. It's gotten the least amount of sand in it, but it's like a $50 booty. If you fish a lot, it's well worth it. But if you are only going down to the beach once or twice a month, you can go to some of the local sporting goods shops and get what they call like a pool shoe for $10.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The only thing I recommend on that is you get them one size smaller than you normally would wear because they'll be tight. That'll help keep the sand out. Now, having said that, last year I got stung by a ray. I stepped on it, and its stinger went right through the top of my foot. And I will do the public service announcement right now. You do not want that to happen. It hurts. It is the most painful thing I have ever had done to me. And it went right through that little thin neoprene sock. I did take that one back to David, and he has told me he was going to try to work on making one armored, meaning taking the hard sole that he has and encasing the whole shoe. But I haven't gotten back to him to see if he's done that. But So there are quite a few guys that do wear their wading boots even when they're wet wading, just because of that.
Because of that, the rays and
and
the rocks in some areas, I suppose, too.
Correct. And we also have another fish that's in the skate family. It's round with a tail, and it's called a thornback because it's got three rows of thorns that when it's at rest, you don't really see them. But if you step on them, they come out. So, yeah, you've got to wear some kind of footwear on the beach, whether it's and I've tried them all. I've tried sandals, tennis shoes, the wading boots, the $10, you know, pool shoes. Literally, I've gone down in Crocs. I've tried them all.
You
know, nothing beats your waders and your wading boots unless it's 85 degrees out. But, you know, that's the price.
Okay, one more question that maybe crosses over into safety. Phil McCartney wrote in on the internet here and says, he says, are there frequent casting challenges that one should be prepared for when fishing the surf? Wind, curious tourist, walking into your back cast area, beach restrictions come to mind. Anything like that?
The only beach restrictions will be is if you're fishing in an area where there's a lot of bathers and the lifeguards might ask you to leave. because as they told me one time, their number one priority is the bathers, and then they said it's the surfers, and then it's the people walking on the beach. Fishermen fell way down the list.
List.
I will tell you that part of that question is perfect because when I walk out with a client, one of the things I remind them is they are now responsible for all the morons on the beach. Meaning, if you are right-handed, they will stand on the right side to watch you cast. They will stop behind you to pick up shells. They will throw the ball for their dog out right where you just cast. So you have to be aware of that constantly. Even though we are making a demonstrative motion with our cast, we're not just using a spinning rig, making one quick snap, throw it out there and reel it in. You know, we're making back casts, and people do not notice you. So you have to really get used to being able to cast and look to the side when you're doing it, and you can judge somebody, okay, that person's that far up there, I can get another cast in before they go. That's one of the big reasons why I like early in the morning. Right now I can get out there and fish at 5:30. There are very, very few people. So from that aspect, people are, and even other fishermen don't, you know, that aren't used to the fly fishing will see you and they'll even get in your way. So, you have to watch everybody.
Okay. Okay, let's talk about food and flies out there. What are most of these surf perch eating? Are they after minnows, crabs? What are they after?
All the fish that are in the surf are just, they feed opportunistically. They're going to eat pretty much anything that comes by. And so you will have bait fish. You will have sand crabs. You might even get the smaller crabs that will come in. There's worms. There's little shrimp. There's sand fleas. Anything that gets in there that they can eat, and they're not real specific. I mean, I can get into that with the flies. You ask about the flies. This is the beauty about the beach. Anything that's red will catch fish. And okay. It seems like a very simple answer, but I have taken a bear hook, tied an inch and a half strip of micro red chenille on it, no weight, no nothing, thrown it out, and caught perch. A couple weeks later, I was in an area where I saw a guy I haven't seen in a while, and I said, "Hey, I did that old test, you know, that we always talked about." And he said, "Oh, yeah, I put a cigarette butt on a bear hook and caught a perch." So the perch kind of aren't your measuring stick as to if the fly works or not. If you tie a fly that catches the perch, the halibut, the corbina, and maybe one of the shark species, then you're in there. Then you have something. I'm kind of lazy where I don't want to change fly, so I don't have a perch fly, a corbina fly, or a halibut fly, because all the flies that I'm using have caught all the species before I put them into a fly shop or on my website or anything like that, because I want to know that if someone gets these, they should catch fish. You know, I have
that brings up Terry Martin's question from Portland, Oregon. What are your go-to flies?
Well, once again, if Terry ties, he could tie a red woolly bugger with the 532nd weighted eyes, put them on the bottom of the hook so it rides hook up, and then you palmer in that red feather. All you have to do then is cut it flush on the bottom so it doesn't roll. He should catch all the fish he wants. But flies, most of the people, you know, like all the people that I started with and are fishing, we all have flies that we tie and they work. What I have is I have a series of flies that I call checkerboards, because I have variegated chenille. And the variegated chenille is a chenille that is two colors. Like one of them that I have is red, olive, red, olive, red, olive. So when I wrap the body, you get both those colors. Mm-hmm. And I have another one that this is kind of a funny thing. It's fluorescent red, but it looks pink. So it's pink, black, pink, black. And I put a red tail, and I use hot pink thread. And that has caught everything. I have a burnt orange and yellow, with orange thread and an orange marabou tail. That's caught everything. So I like, you know, I had somebody one time tell me, "Boy, your flies are really simple." And I told them, "Well, I'm not trying to be tricky. I want you to be able to duplicate them. I don't want to tie anything that somebody else can't duplicate. I want people to be able to duplicate them. They work, so, you know, it's...
Okay. I noticed in your book you have a bunch of sand crab patterns, though, too.
Yeah, that's kind of a funny thing, too. I tie four different sand crab patterns. They all work really well, but I don't fish them really anymore. I fish the checkerboards. I tie them because they do work and people want them. And here's my theory on this. If you've ever been to a beach when there's what I call a sand crab bloom, when you've got hundreds of thousands of sand crabs coming out of the sand and getting into the water, how is that fly that I've tied going to differentiate itself from all that mess? So I can throw out an orange fly or a red fly or a pink fly. It's kind of like the little story I use is if you walk into a room and there's 50 redhead women and one blonde woman, who do you notice? Mm-hmm. You notice the blonde, and that's what I do with the fly. It's really on the beach, it's all color. I don't want to say we don't do because there's people that do it, but I don't worry about matching a hatch. It's all color to me.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Let's see what else we have. Kevin in Wilson, Pritzner in Wilson, Wyoming. How much does species and time of year dictate the flies? I guess you just really answered that. It doesn't dictate it at all, really, right?
No, it's really if you're going to get, because I can go down and I can fish. Generally, when I go down, I fish the red-tailed checkerboard, and if I don't catch fish, they're not there. And I don't want to sound arrogant, but I'm throwing my best stuff. I'm throwing and I'm covering the water, and I'm not just throwing it out once. I'm making 6 to 8 casts, and I'm varying the angle. I'm throwing straight out, and then, you know, I'm working my way almost to parallel to the shore. And if I don't catch something, I'll move to another piece of structure. It's
okay.
I don't spend a lot of time casting into an area that's not productive.
Right, right. Yeah, and for those folks that aren't looking at what I'm looking at, which is the checkerboard instructions for tying, as Lee described it before, it just looks like a chenille body with the eyes and then a marabou tail. I mean,
yeah.
It's really simple.
I was doing a tying demonstration at a convention, and a woman came up to me and picked it up, turned it over in her fingers, and looked at me and said, "All it is a woolly-less woolly bugger."
Right,
and,
right.
And I said, "You're
with
correct."
Eyes.
Yeah, and I said, "You're correct." And
mm-hmm.
She wanted to argue, and I kept telling her, "No, you're correct.
You're right."
Yeah, and she just kind of huffed and walked away, you know, and I kind of take it as a compliment if somebody says, "Wow, that's really simple," you know, because, you know, if I know people that spend 30 minutes tying the fly, and I can tell you with a reasonable doubt, bit of certainty, the fish don't care how elaborate it is.
Right. Another last question about flies. Ron from Berwyn, Illinois, says, "I have relatives that live in San Diego. What flies would you recommend for that area as well as areas to fish?" So take your flies down there, and they should work just fine as well, wouldn't you
think? Yeah, I have people down there that I have clients that have come up from San Diego and fished with me, and then, they'll get, you know, a dozen flies and go back. Yeah, it's universal up and down this area. They work well anywhere. And if he ties, like I said, just tie any, you know, you could do even the red Estaz or cactus chenille. You can do a body of that with the same weighted eyes with a red tail or even an orange tail, and that'll work. You know, it's really color. And the reds, the orange, the yellows, and the pinks are really what work good.
Okay. Let's move on to talking about finding structure and presentations down there. Terry Martin, Portland, Oregon, asks, "How do you determine where to fish and what to use?" We've talked about what to use, but is there certain conditions you look for?
I always look for structure. One of the things that if you read about, let's just say, surf fishing, not necessarily keep it to fly fishing, the rule of thumb has always been you go to the beach 2 hours before peak high tide and fish until 2 hours after. Well, that's fine if you're fishing conventional gear because you can put on a 3 or 4 ounce sinker and throw it 50 yards. But we're limited by distance and depth. So I like low tides. I like going there. I can go an hour before or right at peak low tide because now I can easily identify the structure. I can get close to the structure. I can even see the fish now, the shovel-nose guitar fish, the corbina, and even the perch will come into just inches of water, and you'll see that at low tide. You won't see it as well or at all at a higher tide. So it's much more beneficial at a low tide for the fly fishing, but it's always about structure, and it's identifying the structure. What I call it is fishing where the fish should be.
Okay. Now, you know, structure could mean different things in different parts of the world and different kind, you know, different water. Chris in Rogers, Arkansas, wrote it, and he says, "If I'm on an otherwise nondescript section of the beach, no rocks, no obvious ledges, where should I start casting and how long should I stay before moving on?" So maybe that's the leading question into talking about holes, trenches, and troughs and those kind of structures that you have in the surf that you don't have in a stream or a lake.
Right. And one thing I'll say about the structure before I describe it is it's not always going to be there because of the two high tides and the two low tides we have in a 24-hour period. So basically every 6 hours, the tide changes, and that moves the sand. So if you do have some depth in the sand, it's not going to always be there like in that stream or river. You know, you can count on that seam by that rock. And the
right.
only thing that changes with that is could be the water depth, you know, the volume
right.
of water in there, that area. Whereas on the beach, we lose it daily. It changes daily. And right now we're hoping for a nice big storm to give us some structure that will last us through the summer because the structure we have around here is starting to fill in. So, but the three main things you're going to find on a beach is what I call a hole. And a hole to me looks like a horse hoof print with the closed end of the horseshoe facing the beach. So that's when you look at how a horse steps, it's always deeper. The indentation is deeper at the front, and then it tapers off. And that's kind of like what a hole does. And the easiest way to identify structure, two ways. One, when you get a uniform line of swells that come in, you could have a hole where the wave breaks on either side of it, but it never breaks in that hole area. The swell never peaks and breaks, but it does so once it passes it. The other way is that water that's in there will be green water. It won't have a lot of foam on it. So you can identify it by green water and also the waves not breaking. So that's a hole, and I like fishing that from the uphill side. So if you look out at the water, it would be to your right because 99% of the time our current on the beach flows downhill or to our left. So if you throw up onto like the flat and it rolls over into that hole, you're getting a natural drift like water, like the food, like the current brings the food, and those fish will be there waiting for food to come over that ledge. A trench is just pretty much what you're thinking. They'll usually run quite a ways parallel to the beach. So if you walk down to the beach, you might have to walk into a 3-foot trench, and then on the other side, the beach is flat. And then a trough, the easiest way to describe a trough is think of the Nike swoosh, but instead of the big hand being on the right, you know, side, flip it so that pointy end comes down. And that would be how that starts. It goes, and where the big wide end of that swoosh is, that's where the water meets the surf and goes out beyond it. So it's a channel that goes from the apex of the point, gets larger as it goes downhill, and then sweeps out.
So a trench is water moving out, almost like a
when the tide comes in, that apex could have no water in it, and those fish will move up in towards that apex, and the apex is where the lip or the flat of the beach, where the dry sand then meets the wet sand, it'll drop down, and the back edge is where there's a flat on the ocean side comes in, and it drops down. And those two lips right there will meet at a point. That won't be exactly a point. It'll be a little rounded. But those fish move up into that. As the more water comes in, they move up into that. And I love fishing the apexes. I generally fish the uphill side of most pieces of structure because the fish get up there and it kind of dead ends until you get high tide, and then they can move out. And that's another benefit of being there at low tide, because if you've got structure that, let's say, is 2 to 3, maybe even 4 feet deep, the fish should be there even at a low tide. So now not only are they easy to access, but they should be concentrated. So, you know, and then when as the tide comes in, it could be 3-4 hours later, well, they move out of that area because it's 4 feet deep everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've got Let me just try to review this because I know it might be hard for people to visualize.
It's hard to describe it without seeing it. It really, I've had people that have read the book and then they hire me and they take them out on the beach and I point it out and then it really, the light bulb comes on. It really clicks. But, you know, it's kind of hard to describe it, you know, just over the phone.
Yeah. I'm just looking at, just reading your description in the book here. So when you're talking of backing up to holes, if I see water coming in and I see white froth on the left and white froth on the right, but nothing kind of in the middle, that's indicating a deeper part of the structure underneath and a possible hole. Is
correct.
Correct? Okay.
Correct. Perfectly described.
Okay. So what's happening is the water is hitting shallower areas and creating the waves.
Right, yeah. Waves,
and deeper, it's got no friction there, so it just passes through.
Right, yeah. Waves, the swells come in, and they form into a wave, and the wave breaks in the shallowest water. So there's always an outside edge, you know, that slopes up from the depths, and the waves will break there. Well, they could roll across a section of flat beach, and all of a sudden, they get to a section that's deeper, they'll reform and break again. Or, as you just said, there could be an area far, a little farther out where you look at a wave that could be, you know, 50 yards long, but it doesn't break in a section. Mm-hmm. And by not breaking, where the wave just forms, you know, it like the swell just gets big, but it never breaks. It never topples over. That'll tell you. So that's, the water doesn't change. Like you said, it could be white foam on either side, but it'll be green water there.
Now, how do you? Now, what would be your presentation to a hole like that?
How would
you line up to it, and then how would you cast to it and fish it?
Well, I really fish a lot of those, the uphill side. So where it would.
What do you mean by uphill? I mean,
well,
I'm
if
thinking
you, once
the
again,
beach
if
is
you,
flat.
If you look, well, if you look out at the water, to your right is up. It's like when I live down here in Southern California, if I go to San Francisco, I say I'm going up to San Francisco.
Right.
I'm going down to San Diego. So when I look out, up is to my right, down is to my left.
Okay.
So it's just a way of describing the direction. The other thing that you have to remember is these fish are dedicated to the tides and the surges. So when the water recedes, when the tide goes out, if they're in a trough or a trench or even a hole, they will go out to deeper water if there's a good, what I call road, which it could be just a channel that leads out of this
mm-hmm.
structure. And they'll follow that out. So there's a good way to start on a piece of structure at low tide is on the left side or that downhill side of it, the lowest side to the left, because as the tide comes in, they come in and move uphill or to the right. So you can follow that. Same way if you're fishing at a high tide, I would fish right to left or uphill to downhill as they went out. But if there's deep enough structure, I will go to that apex or that uphill or to the farthest right side of that structure and fish there.
Mm-hmm.
That's also a good spot to find the corbina.
So are you, if you're studying the water there and you're seeing the movement of the water, and it's going to have a repeating pattern, right?
Correct.
In other words, the water comes in, it may be going back out during through a channel, through a hole area or whatever. Now, do you want to fish? Can you think of this at all as a stream in the ocean where you're fishing that current? Or
yeah, and you asked this, and I want to answer that. You don't get locked into throwing one direction. You can throw straight out. If I walk to a piece of structure, I'll throw straight out couple times, I'll go, so if you think a straight out is 12 o'clock, then I'll throw at 11, I'll throw at 10, I'll throw at 9. I might even throw parallel to the beach. Because every time you cast out into an area, there's current that's taking it downhill or to your left, unless there's very little movement. And that doesn't happen really a lot. So you get a drift, and your line, there might get a bow in it. So you always want to stay as tight to the fly as you can, which brings us, how do we strip the fly back? We strip it as fast as we need to stay in really straight line, good contact. If the tide is coming in and there's not a lot of downhill surge, and what I mean by that is, I believe because we're above the equator, it always comes in and then rolls downhill or to our left. You can actually watch the water and it'll move to our left. Now, it doesn't do it all the time, but that's the majority. So if it's moving to your left fast, you have to strip faster. If it's letting you pull that fly back slowly in a straight line, I mean, it's keeping it straight. It's not taking it right or left. I go very slow. My whole thing is I want to give those fish, because it is visual with the color, I want to give them as much time to see it as possible. I do have friends that do a very fast strip and they catch fish. I just think I have a better hookup rate going slower, and it's worked with clients. So all this has been applied to people who have never been on the beach, and it works for them, so that kind of always reaffirms what I'm thinking. You know?
Right. Okay, a good question from Joe in New York. On a new beach or piece of water, is it worth is to spend time prospecting or walking the beach looking for signs of feeding fish before casting a line?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Unless where you park, if you walk, like one thing nice about Southern California, there's like up here in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties, you can drive along the ocean and look and decide whether or not you want to stop. So it's kind of nice that way. But if you park and you walk out to the beach, the first thing I do is I look for structure. And I might have to walk, 150 yards to find something that I feel is really good for fishing, and I might pass stuff that I'll make a mental note, like use a landmark that's up the beach and say, okay, I'm going to come back and check this, but I want to go. It's like if you're at a buffet, you want to go to the stuff you really like, you'll go back and get the other stuff later.
Yeah. And there was a question from DB about kind of what you were just talking about in Escondido. He says, I've read a number of articles about fishing the surf that is best to cast at an angle to the beach to keep your fly in the valley between the sandbars the longest. So he must be talking about a trough or something,
yes.
Right?
Yes, uh-huh.
That makes sense to me. However, when I listen to speakers on fly fishing the surf, they always seem to demonstrate throwing directly out from the shore. What am I not understanding about this?
I always try to tell people you throw to different angles. Don't get locked into throwing just straight out. I mean, there's places where I will do that, but if I don't get bit on three casts, I'm changing that angle. And, just like I think in any fishing, if you were to talk to 10 guides that go for trout, you're going to get 10 different opinions. And it's just finding what works for you, It really, like I said, I don't want to ever limit what I'm doing, so I'm going to throw different angles. I've done throwing parallel to the beach. There's when we get halibut start showing up on the beach, I throw more at a 45-degree angle because I'm in the zone that they're in longer versus if I would throw straight out. I'm coming back through a very narrow zone for them, whereas if I throw more at a 45-degree angle, I'm covering more of where they are. And in some trenches and in some troughs, you have to fish that angle, you know, because you will be in that zone longer. So he's really, he picked it up, you know, by figuring out to do it that way. Yeah, you're just not, you know, and if you make a dozen good casts into an area and you don't get bit, move. You know, you,
okay,
you don't own the land, you're just passing through, so.
Okay, yeah, that kind of finishes answering Chris's question earlier about how long should I stay before moving on. So
right.
I'm
yeah,
glad
it's,
you brought that up.
Yeah. I have guys that I fish with, friends that I fish with, that I could be 100 yards down the beach and they're still casting into the same area. And what is the definition of crazy is doing the same thing, expecting a different outcome?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, if you're going to make 100 casts into the same area, you might as well just soak bait.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like being mobile. I want to move around and see what I
yeah.
can see.
There's an interesting question from Dan in Redwood City, California. He says, what advantages can a fly angler leverage in surf fishing to get the edge over a bait or spin fisherman? In what situations do we have a presentation advantage?
A lot of the guys that spin fish, they fish two ways. Well, I should say three ways. They either use sand crabs, live sand crabs, the plastic or rubber grubs, or they're fishing Berkeley Gulp, and the Berkeley Gulp is made with flavor and scent. So that stuff can be hard to beat, but a lot of those guys are throwing just straight out. They'll catch fish because of what they're doing, and if you look at the Berkeley Gulp, the two colors that work best for them are, one is all red, and the other one is red and olive. So, once again, we go right back to color. You know, they've made it great because it's seen, but it also has flavor. You know, it's, I mean, it's all, it's made, you know, it's infused with it. The whole thing is taste. So, the answer to his question is, it's knowing how to read the water, and that's the biggest issue. I've gone to the beach many times and outfished those guys because they're standing there throwing out on a flat section of beach. And, you know, there's people that do that, and it's all about structure. I think we have an advantage because we know how to cast. We know how to fly cast. It's so much more fun. You know, fly casting fits my attention span. I'm always
yeah.
doing something. You know,
well, I think we have to be smarter because we're putting out a lot more effort to get the flies out to where they need to be and to get them in and get them back out than a, you know, spinner bait caster has to do. So we need to be looking more carefully. I
right.
mean,
also, once again, we're limited by the distance.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, I had my client working a piece of structure, and there's a gentleman coming down with a spinning reel, you know, light stuff. But he can fish a three-quarter ounce, you know, sinker on that. He can throw that really, really far. So he's covering more ground than we can.
Right, right.
And that's
right.
that's really the issue that I see is it's that distance. You know, so...
Yeah.
If you can throw, once again, you know, there's no reason to throw 100 feet. It kind of the rule that I go by is you only throw as far as you can control.
Right.
You know,
right.
So, I mean, if you're getting a big swing, meaning you have a big bow in your line, it's going to be hard to get a hook set that, like a perch will bring that fly in and spit it out before you can even know it.
Yeah.
And they pretty much
yeah.
just hook themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it kind of is similar to, you know, fishing streams or lakes for trout, you know. Many of my guests on the show always say, hey, the biggest mistake I see people make is wading in before they fish the shore. Or
yeah.
the, you know,
yeah.
and because you're stepping on the fish you could have caught, you know.
Yeah.
So it sounds like that's, you know, a situation in the surf as well.
It is, but I try to really counsel people in that. Don't, like, I tell people, yeah, there's just 30 feet out in front of you, there's fish. Well, now they're throwing 30 feet thinking they're going to catch fish, but they're cutting their odds way down by not throwing 60, 65, or 70. You know, you don't want to concentrate on that because you can cast it out and bring it back through that same area, but also cover 30 feet past it. So, you know, that's the big thing.
Right. A couple of last questions here, and then we got to finish up. A couple came in on the Internet I want to get. Richard Gilman in Monterey Bay says, Lee, do you like fishing the flats, in other words, in between holes and rips?
The only time I would fish those if I saw either shovel-nose guitar fish on them or corbina on them. It's structure. The fish are really holding better in structure.
Okay.
If the entire beach is flat, well, then we're fishing, you know, wherever we can find a high or a low spot. And one thing I wanted to let you know, Richard, right now, if we're running down this, anybody that has a question can email me. I love answering questions.
And, again, you want to share your email with folks?
flyfishthesurf@yahoo.com.
There you go, flyfishthesurf@yahoo.com. Another John from Spokane says, since everything, he says, rots so fast, probably rusts so fast, do you bother with stainless steel or cadmium-plated hooks?
The hooks I use are stainless steel, but they still rust, just not as fast.
Yeah.
And
his other part of his question was, how often do you add weight to flies?
I fish 99.9% of my flies with weight.
Weight tied into the fly or weight of the fly?
Yes, the dumbbell eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I might use bead chain eyes, but they're still weighted. You know, there's times if you're fishing over rocks, you know, you could use, if you had a red muddler minnow, you could fish that with a weighted line because it'll stay above the rocks. You know, it's I have flies that I use for that. But most, it's really weighted.
Okay. One more. Phil McCartney again, he says, you mentioned that you like fishing early in the a.m. Do you find that low light conditions are key for the best fishing in relatively shallow water? Or is it just the tide that
That's a good question because there's a few beaches that we have here that before the sun comes over the mountains and hits the water, the bite can be really wide open. And as soon as the sun hits it, I don't want to say the bite stops, but it's not as good. And it's not always like that, but there are days where that happens. I really like the morning because there's no wind, there's less people, so I like getting out on a tide where it's a peak low tide in the early a.m., I have fished them in the afternoon. I have had clients that can only get out in the afternoon. And then we're dealing with a few more people, particularly here in Southern California during the summer. It can get, you know, if you're trying to fish in the afternoon, it can get pretty dodgy. Whereas I can start at 5:30. We fish 5 hours. We're off the water at 10:30. You know, the beach is just starting to pick up.
Yeah.
So it's kind of nice that way.
Okay, one more question, and that's it. Richard Gillum just wrote in from Monterey Bay. He says, Lee, rip currents, are these defined in what you call structure? Some people don't know what these look like. Could you explain the safety involved in fishing these areas?
Well, the one thing about now you're dealing with something that is moving, and it's going to be moving more than likely to your left, and it'll look like nervous water amongst the calm water. And it is actually occurring, and here they always tell you if you're caught in one while swimming, swim parallel to the beach and swim out of it. The problem with a rip current is reaching it. If it's out in deeper water, you're not going to be able to reach it, you know, without putting yourself in standing in deep water, which I don't recommend. So there have been times where I fished them, and I will throw a cast to the back of it, I will throw a cast to the middle of it, and I will throw a cast to the leading edge of it and see if anything's in there because it churns up the bottom, which churns up the food, and the fish will go there. They're not always there, but it's a I would fish that better than fishing a flat on the beach. But it's the access to it. You don't want to put yourself where you're out there in any deep water. You just don't want to do it.
Right. Yeah, from what you said earlier, you should never really be in danger and getting caught in a riptide because
you
shouldn't be that deep, right?
No, I was out 2 weeks ago. I had a client, he's 6'6". Well, he could walk out a lot farther than I could. I'm 5'11", so he could walk out, and I told him, I'm not going out there. You know, it was dangerous for me. For him, it wasn't bad, but... So, you know, unless you're 6'6", no, you don't get out there in deep water. I never take anybody out and put them into, you know, I mean, maybe to their knees, but if the surf is big, we're not even going to get near that.
Okay. All right, we got to wrap things up. We've run long because of the late start. Sorry about that, folks, but let's wrap this up and give away a few gifts. Going to give away that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and, of course, a copy of Lee's book, Fly Fishing the Surf, courtesy of Amato Books. So stick with me just a minute longer or two, and we'll get those gifts going here. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts to continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers. The Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website. It's at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. Okay. Now, giveaways. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what do you think of this show? Just click on that link, leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away some prizes. So the winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. And if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show. You know, you don't miss out on some of the great prizes we have to give away. And if you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and get the information we need to send you your gift. Okay, so let's fire up the old database here and see what we can come up with. Eric Halloran in Massachusetts. So, Eric, you are proud owner of a membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, so congratulations. And, all right, good. Now, one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. And this is courtesy of Amato Books as well. So those of you that aren't familiar with Amato Books, go to amatobooks.com. You'll see all the books they have to offer as well as periodicals. And our winner here is... Jeffrey Thrash in Pennsylvania. So congratulations, Jeffrey. I'm sure you'll enjoy that subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. Okay, now let's give away Lee's book, Fly Fishing the Surf, courtesy of Amato Books. And this just got published, by the way, so it's brand new out there. So I know whoever wins it will enjoy it. Let me just clear my queue here real quick and make sure I don't have any stuff sitting in there. Oh, interesting. Okay. There we go. Okay. So now you need to go to the homepage, type in that text box where you put submitted questions during the show. Put in your name, your location, and answer this question. So the question is, we talked about three types of structure. What are those three types of structure? Three types of structure. Give me those three types of structure, and you'll win Lee's book. Okay, I'm just waiting for them to type away here, Lee. And then,
well, I want to let everybody know that I am also a member of the Federation of Fly Fishermen, so they do a really good job for us, and it's a worthwhile thing to join.
Okay, we've got our first answer in here, and the answer is hole, trench, and trough. Does he have it right?
Winner.
Winner. Okay, that's Silas Gray. Hey, Silas. Silas has listened to, I think, every show I've ever done. He's a longtime listener, so I'm glad he was able to win, and he got it right. So, Silas, send me your mailing address, either in the same text box or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, info@askaboutflyfishing.com. So I need your name. I got your email address here. I just need your mailing address so that we can have Amato send out a copy of the book to you. So congratulations, and get your rear end out to California. You got an excuse now, and go see Lee, and he'll help you use that book. So, well, hey, Lee, thanks for being on the show tonight. I really appreciate you taking your time out, and it was great to have you, and I know everybody learned a lot.
Not a problem. I appreciate it. And once again, if anybody's got any questions, flyfishtosurf@yahoo.com. If you didn't get a chance to ask them, just shoot me an email.
Can't ask for more than that. Thanks, Lee.
You got
it. Our next broadcast will be on June 17th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. On that show, I'll be interviewing Phil Shook. And our topic for the show will be Mexico's Grand Slam Expressway. Phil has traveled and fished extensively throughout Mexico. He considers the three giant estuaries off Highway 307 in Quintana Roo some of the best flats fishing in Mexico. Ascension, Espiritu, and Chetumal will definitely have you on the hunt for your Grand Slam. So join us for that show. We'd like to thank Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Book, Stackpole Books, Platte River Fly Shop, Harper Creek Fly Fishing Company, Front Range Anglers for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.